Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this episode of City Talks. Today, my guest is Anna Stansbury. Anna is Assistant Professor of Work and Organisation Studies at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Anna is also the co-author, along with Dan Turner and Ed Balls, of a new working paper called Tackling the UK's Regional Economic Inequality, Binding Constraints and Avenues for Policy Intervention. Welcome, Anna. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the paper came out in early March. I guess you must be very pleased with the reaction and the responses. I mean, it was, you know, we thought it was excellent, but my sense is that, you know, the wider world also thought it was excellent. So were you pleased and maybe surprised by the response?
Yeah, I guess it's just been great to see that the analysis has resonated with a lot of people and they found it interesting. I mean, you know, to the extent that people have agreed or even to the extent they've disagreed, there's been a lot of debate. There's been a lot of discussion with people who are engaged in making policy or analysing policy. So it's been fantastic to get that kind of discussion going, honestly.
Yeah, no, it's definitely it's definitely sort of started a set of conversations or reinvigorated a set of conversations in some respects, which I think it is fantastic. And yeah. I think there's many reasons, but maybe we can start with one of the reasons, because it's the sort of second bit of the title, really, which I think is quite an interesting one. And many of us, me included, you know, recognize this was a novel approach or a more novel approach to thinking about the issues that some of us are familiar with, which is the idea of the binding constraints approach. Just say a little bit about what that is, because it's more akin to development economics maybe than the sort of urban economics. So just tell us a little bit about what that binding constraints idea is, and then why you adopted that particular approach.
Yeah, absolutely. So the binding constraints logic comes out of the growth diagnostics framework for development economics, as you said, that was developed by Ricardo Hausmann, Danny Roderick, and Andres Velasco about two decades ago. And the logic of that framework for development economics was, if you're looking at developing economies, we know that there are lots of inputs that are necessary for good economic growth. You know, you need a highly educated population, you need a stable macroeconomic environment, you need a good financial system, infrastructure, you can list them all off. But the problem is, if you look at a developing country, honestly, in most cases, all of those are not present to some degree. And so if you're a policymaker trying to prioritize, you don't know if there's a lack of access to finance for firms because the financial system isn't working, or because there are a lack of productive business opportunities for all these other reasons, and therefore banks aren't going to exist to lend to firms because firms don't have any way of doing activity that would generate, that would justify bank lending. So there's this kind of chicken and egg problem where every input looks like it's missing, but you don't actually know if it's missing in a way that means if you increase the amount of that input that's present, that would generate growth, or if it's just missing because the entire environment is not conducive to growth. So Hausmann, Roderick, and Velasco developed this framework that was trying to understand which of these inputs would be the most impactful if you as a policymaker increased it now in terms of generating the conditions for growth. So we took that logic and wanted to apply it in the context of a region of an industrialized economy. So obviously a lot of those conditions no longer apply if you're looking at a region of the UK or another industrialized economy. We're less worried about institutional climate and macroeconomic stability, but a lot of these logics still applies. So if you look at the regions outside London and the southeast of the UK, you can compare in levels and say, there is a lower level of population education, both at the tertiary and secondary level. There is less infrastructure. There is less bank lending and equity financing. There is less R&D activity. There are less business starts. But you again don't know which of those is the one that on the margin, if you improved it as a policymaker, would generate the most growth. So that's the logic of our intervention is, as a policymaker, you need to prioritize. Everything looks like it could be important. Therefore, this logic will help us figure out which ones are the most impactful.
And I think, one of the things I thought was interesting is, in a sense, adopting that sort of approach it helps you think about the size and scale of the impact, or the size and scale of the problem, as it were. Is it big? Is it small? You know, are you far away? Are you close to what you might expect? And then, you know, as you turn towards sort of what you might do about it, it begins to implicitly as well as explicitly encourage a degree of prioritization, in the sense that you might find that, you know, actually you're far away from where you need to be on one thing, and that might be the big binding constraint, or a bigger binding constraint than something else. Do you agree with that, in the sense it helps that sort of scale and impact and then prioritization?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the right characterization. And the way that we can try to do that prioritization is basically, for each of these inputs, we try and infer from the behavior of private sector market participants, like firms and individuals, which of these factors look like they're in high demand from firms, and which of these factors look like they're not. So are firms really champing at the bit to get more bank lending? And are we seeing that banks are not lending enough? Can we sort of use a supply and demand analysis to see if there's not enough supply of lending relative to firms' demand? We do that kind of logic for every factor. And then that enables us to prioritize and say, right now, certain factors look like they're in high demand from firms relative to supply, and government can help provide more of them. And other factors look like they're not as in high demand from firms relative to supply. And so those might be the next step, but not the first step in our journey to generate higher growth and productivity in the regions.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Okay, so let's start to get into the findings and the way the paper is structured. And I think someone else sort of commented on it, said, you know, the paper a little bit reads like a good detective novel, which is, you know, you've got these kind of clues there, but you don't know what the culprit, who is the murderer, or the criminal, and you have to work through the steps in order to do it. Which when I read it, I thought, yeah, that's a good way of kind of. But starting off, which again I think is quite an important point to make, a framing point, is the paper, you know, rightly says that, you know, these problems, we observe these problems or these variations in productivity across the UK, and we're fairly confident that there aren't self-correcting mechanisms, i.e. these places are stuck, right? We can we can define the stuck and what that actually means, but in a sense, we don't see self-correcting mechanisms either in the UK or indeed anywhere else that will allow these places to kind of resolve their own problems or to resolve the situation that they find themselves in. Is that a fair sort of summary?
Yes, and I think that's been one of the most striking lessons in, I guess, regional economics in the last 40 years or so, is the degree to which these disparities are not self-correcting. And that's not just true of the UK, that's true of the US, that's true of parts of Northern Europe and Southern Europe as well, is these differences just seem to persist over time. In incomes, in productivity, one of the ways you would think it would self-correct is that firms would see that it's cheaper to operate somewhere else, and there's all this pool of labor that isn't being sufficiently used, and they would go there. You don't see that happening as much as you would think. But also, you don't see people moving in many places as much as you would think to the economic opportunity. So both of those mechanisms don't seem to be functioning to lead to a self-correction. And one thing that's striking about the UK is that the UK's scope of these productivity disparities is particularly high. The level is very high relative to other countries. So one fact that really stands out to us is, if you take the average worker productivity, so GVA per worker, for London and the Southeast, and then the average for the rest of the UK, that disparity is as big, actually bigger now, than the gap between East and West Germany or North and South Italy. And East and West Germany has been converging, but the UK has been diverging. Yeah. So the persistence and nature of our gaps is actually getting bigger and more entrenched over time.
And that's a really important point, because as you say, long term, no self-correcting mechanisms. There's a cumulative process going on where initial advantages are building, you know, are then accumulated over time, which reinforces the sort of the good cycle versus the bad cycle. And so thinking about, which when we get to the policy bit, suggests that, you know, fairly substantive things are going to probably need to be done in order to try and deal with some of these sort of the cycles that we see, rather than tinkering at the edges, which is partly how we would describe policy over the last period, is probably not going to do it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a good metaphor for it is a sort of flywheel type effect that seems to happen for the biggest global cities. And you've seen London as a beneficiary of this, but also other global cities, where once you reach a certain size, you know, agglomeration economies and specialization and high knowledge intensive services and activities enables these big global cities to take off. And the big question for the UK is, why are other not so big cities haven't quite reached that critical mass or productivity, and how we can generate that, you know, perhaps not to the degree of London, but certainly to the degree of other 2 million people-ish cities in other countries.
Yeah, no, that's a nice piece. So let's get into some of the chunks of findings. And obviously we can't do the paper full justice, Anna, because, you know, people will need to read it. There's lots of pages. But you know, you look at sort of four areas, and you don't look at one area, which we'll come back to at the end, which is institutions and governance and all that. You allude to it, but you don't go into the detail, but we can come on to that towards the end. But you do look a big bucket around skills, a big bucket around infrastructure, mainly physical, but you do say something about digital. A big bucket around R&D and, you know, innovation, you know, more broadly. And then you do look at sort of finance or access to finance. So let's do the skills one, because I think the skills one, my impression is that prompted, you know, most of the sort of, aha, this is interesting, I hadn't thought about that, are you sure type responses. So again, you know, you give us a summary very, you know, of what it is that you're finding in the skills bucket. And then we can dig into it in a little bit more detail.
I think the argument in the skills piece is we're looking at post-secondary skills here. And we argue that, I guess, a bit against some of the conventional wisdom, a generalized lack of university graduate skills is not the major binding constraint on the regions outside London and the Southeast anymore. And that it probably was in the 90s, and the massive expansion of higher education that's happened since then helped alleviate that binding constraint. But we argue there does seem to be evidence for a specific shortage of STEM skills. So the way that we come to that argument, and the piece of evidence we generate that I think a lot of people haven't seen before and are really interested by, is we estimate a university wage premium for each region. So what that means is you're estimating how much more does a university graduate make relative to an A-level graduate in each of these regions of the same age and sex. You know, you're correcting for different composition of the workforce demographically. And what we find is that in the 1990s, the university wage premium was higher for graduates outside London relative to an A-level graduate in their same region than it was in London. As university education expanded everywhere, that university wage premium fell very sharply in every region, essentially every region except London. And now, as of the late 2010s, at least, the university wage premium is higher in London than it is outside. So the combination of those three facts is basically suggesting that in a very classic economic supply and demand framework, we increase the supply of university graduates. And if demand stays constant and you increase supply, what happens? The relative price falls. So the relative price firms are willing to pay for a university graduate falls over time. And that suggests to us, okay, this increase in supply of graduates means that they're less scarce now relative demand. Firms outside London are less willing now to pay a really high premium to get those graduate skills, but they're still willing to pay a really high premium for STEM skills. And that's the one area where we haven't seen this decline in the university wage premium outside London. So we suggest that the emphasis now should shift a lot more to being specifically focusing on STEM skills at the university level, but also getting secondary level students ready to be able to get those tertiary level STEM skills as well.
Yeah, because we would ideally want there to be some kind of wage premium, right, in a sense, to incentivize, you know, the educational attainment at the individual level. But we wouldn't want the premium to be enormous, because that would tell us that there's a scarcity problem, you know, that we're probably undersupplying in a harmful way, you know, that particular input, which is at that, you know, that point is the graduate. Is that fair?
That's exactly right, yeah.
And what's your sense in that one around, well, a couple of thoughts on that. You know, it's, what's your reflections on why we haven't seen a sort of demand side response to the, you know, we've had a supply increase on the graduate side or on the labor side, and yet we haven't really seen a kind of demand side response in on the firm side in order to, you know, to better utilize that, you know, that particular input. And what we've actually seen, I think, you know, in other data is that we've seen, you know, graduates essentially doing lots of non-graduate type activities, right? In the sense that they're going into the labor market, but they're actually going into often into non-graduate jobs and non-graduate activity. What's your sense as to, you know, how those two factors interact? Is there a lag? Would you suppose that?
So it's not entirely clear, but the logic of it could be something like, there are other things now that are preventing firms from generating more of the kinds of jobs that would be high paying graduate jobs in the regions outside London and the Southeast. So it's, I keep saying outside London because in London, the graduate wage premium hasn't fallen. Yeah. So as that supply has shifted out, firms have been able to continue to generate new graduate jobs that are making use of those graduate skills. Yeah. So I think that what we take away from it is exactly what you're saying. We're now running into a place where a lot of the new graduates are not finding highly productive graduate level jobs. This is bringing down on average the graduate wage premium. And that is suggestive of the fact that there is some other issue going on that makes it hard for firms to generate these jobs. And this then points to, is there a lack of sort of knowledge spillovers that enable us to generate more high knowledge intensity graduate level, you know, either goods or services exporting firms? Is there something else going on with agglomeration economies where firms can't find the right mix of workers to generate the kind of productivity they would need to? So that's an exactly a reflection of the dynamic we're talking about, and would suggest that simply pushing more and more people into university without thinking about the demand side, without thinking about what's going to generate the jobs for them at the end, won't necessarily be the most effective path anymore.
Yeah. And a slightly sort of nerdy sort of technical point, but Anna, you work in this field, we work in this field, data limitations are a massively binding constraint on analysis, which is significant. So, you know, that is true. That is a given. We should never forget that. What's your thought around, or speculation around, you know, if you're doing it at the kind of regional level. If we were doing it this, you know, at sort of smaller geography level, let's say we were trying to think about what's going on in Greater Manchester or in the Manchester sort of core area relative to the Northwest, because London, in a sense, is not a region. It's a big city, as I, you know, boringly tell everybody that doesn't ask me, but I tell them anyway. Whereas in the Northwest, you know, it is a big region, of which Manchester is a bit of it and Liverpool's another bit and so on. What's your sense as to whether we would see something similar if we were looking at maybe some of those bigger urban areas within their big regions? Do you think we would see a similar, you know, flattening out of the premium or not?
This is one of the things where we would love to estimate this, and we're actually trying to. So audience, you know, come back to our paper in a few months and hopefully we'll have something on this. We don't for now. My guess is that we would probably see something similar, but it might be a bit attenuated. And the reason is just that in, particularly if we're talking about the Northwest or the West Midlands, the broader city region economies of the large cities in those regions make up quite a large share of those regions' population, and particularly of where the graduate population is. So in some sense, when we're estimating the graduate wage premium for the Northwest, in large part, that is already telling us what's happening for the people in the greater Manchester and Liverpool agglomerations. Having said that, you'd probably expect it to be falling a little less in the cities than it is outside for the reasons that we just talked about. But I'm going to make a plug here, as any good researcher will, that we need more data and better data and more access to data. So that's another important policy binding constraint.
I tip my hat to that recommendation or to that comment. You know, having made it many times myself, it is a good thing. But I think it is an interesting broader point, right? When we try to get into what's actually going on. Genuine limitations on the data front and what we might do to work around it is a non-trivial issue, as you well know. Okay, so that's the kind of big skills bucket, which I think, you know, is I think really good set of findings, which, you know, poses a whole bunch of additional thoughts on it. Let's do the second bucket, which is infrastructure, and you mainly, but not exclusively, mainly focus on transport related kind of infrastructure, and you're looking at different aspects of that. So again, paint the picture of what the findings in that big bucket are.
So if there's one big headline finding from this bucket, it is or one big takeaway, it is Western European cities get people to work through public transport. American cities get people to work through roads, and UK cities are bad at both. So
classically mid-Atlantic, right? Not good at either. We just sit in the middle, we're rubbish at both. So, yeah.
You know, we were the best of both worlds, but in this specific case, it doesn't look like it, sadly. So, I mean, the reason that I'm drawing that conclusion is you can basically look at, and there's data from other researchers we've used for this, what is the effective scope of UK cities in terms of either the number of people or the amount of space that can be reached from the city centre at rush hour. So we've built on analysis by your colleagues at Centre for Cities, who have done this for UK and European cities for public transport. And they have found, that was very striking to us, that for a given size of UK city, particularly Manchester and Birmingham, that are quite large in terms of population, only actually quite a small share of that population can reach the city centre by public transport at rush hour in 30 minutes. Whereas in a lot of European cities, that's a much larger share. And your colleagues have argued that's a combination of a limited public transport network and also low housing density. So we build on that analysis, and we also incorporate analysis from some researchers here in the US, Conwell, Eckerd and Mobarak, who do a similar exercise for global cities, but for area rather than population. Mm-hmm. So they ask, what is the square kilometer space that can be reached from the city center in 30 minutes at rush hour, either by public transport or by road, in the US, Europe, and the UK, and other cities that we are not focusing on. And we find that the UK reaches a much smaller area by public transport than Western European cities, and a much smaller area by road than American cities. We can then look at things like congestion, and we can see that UK roads are much more congested, very much more congested than American roads, and also on average more congested than the roads in Western European cities. So on all these measures that we're looking at, we're seeing that UK cities' effective size and reach is really constrained by this combination of limited congested road infrastructure and limited public transport reach.
Yeah, no, that is, you know, and as you say, you know, the reality is, like, in even in some of our big cities, their effective size is roughly about half of what their actual population size would tell you. Whereas, you know, if you look at some of their comparable places in Western Europe, you know, they are smaller effectively than they are literally, but it's, you know, it's 75-80% size rather than 50% size, and that really does matter. And obviously then that connects into your labor market initial ones around skills and the matching benefits that we get from large labor pools, which allow people and workers and firms to find each other more effectively, more efficiently.
Exactly. If you think about a firm that's trying to find very specialized workers for a particular activity, whether that's a sort of high-tech manufacturing or a professional services firm, if the scope of your labor market is small because people can't actually get to work from the outlying towns very easily, that just makes it a lot harder to set up that firm. That makes it less incentivized people to get those skills or live in those places. So it becomes this vicious cycle. The other thing I would say about transport as well, actually, is when we're looking at the reach of the public transport network in particular, that takes into account where the train lines or bus lines go. And for buses, it takes into account congestion. It doesn't take into account some of these other harder to measure factors like reliability. So, and this has been a big debate, right, recently about train reliability and punctuality. One of the things that really struck us when we looked at train reliability is if you look at the punctuality of trains in the UK, this is pre-COVID, relative to the other EU 27 countries, the UK is much worse than average for the EU in terms of train punctuality overall. And then when you look within the UK, we separate you. So the Office of Rail and Road gives data on train punctuality by rail operator. So it's not regional, but we can separate the operators into ones that largely focus on London and the south of England and those that largely serve areas outside. And you just see this very stark south versus the rest divide on rail, where the trains in London and the south are much more punctual on average than the trains elsewhere. So if you add that factor to the fact that, you know, the train network is already quite small and not serving that many areas, and it just makes it sort of compounds the analysis that we just talked about.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I think back in quite a few years ago now, we did a bit of comparable analysis looking at some of sort of city pairs work type, if you know, in the UK and then in Amsterdam and in the Rhine-Ruhr, because there was a sort of, that was the northern powerhouse original idea. And just to your point, you know, what you find is that actually the time from one pair, you know, between the pairs is roughly equal between the places. But what was noticeably different was frequency and reliability, in a sense that there were more journeys or more travel, more services, and they were more reliable. And that really makes a material difference. It doesn't matter whether it's 45 minutes or an hour, you know, you'll do whatever you need to do. But what you need to do is when you turn up that the thing, you know, the train actually arrives or the bus actually arrives and you can get in it. Or if you miss it, you don't have to wait another hour for the next one. It's, you know, it's 20 minutes. So it's a really good point of I have to bring all of these kind of things together. It's not just about, you know, the way that we often think about these kind of things, which is speed or, you know, distance, that kind of stuff. That's really good.
That's interesting. Yeah, I must look at that.
You touch on digital, but actually it doesn't appear to be a big binding constraint, certainly within the UK, UK to elsewhere possibly, but not within the UK. Is that right?
Yeah. So this is one of the cases where our analysis being only within UK regions feels a little more concerning, in the sense that we look at broadband speeds. Broadband speeds aren't that different in cities across the UK. The difference in the UK and in many other countries is really from urban to rural areas where the broadband speeds are different. So it's not the case that London on average has much higher, faster broadband than other parts of the UK in terms of cities. But the UK looks really bad in international context in terms of broadband speeds. So when we're thinking about factors that hold back the growth of the UK's non-London regions relative to London, broadband speed is not amongst them. When we're looking at factors that hold back their growth overall in a world where fast-paced, knowledge-intensive activities are really important and internet connectivity is really important, broadband probably is a factor in general in holding back the UK's overall growth. It just doesn't seem to be differently happening across regions.
Excellent. We're all equally, you know, the UK is equally bad in terms of digital, which is another marvelous finding, which is depressing, but nevertheless accurate, which I think is really, really good. Okay, so let's go to the third bucket. The third bucket is R&D expenditure. And again, you're thinking about the geography of R&D expenditure. And you're also thinking about the relationship between public R&D broadly and private R&D broadly, and how that plays out across space. So just say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so R&D is a tricky one, because the basic argument is there's a role for the public sector to fund some R&D activity for two reasons. One is it generates knowledge spillovers. So knowledge is at least partly a public good. If you go back to your, you know, first semester economics, that means that it's going to be underprovided by the private market because it's non-rival and non-excludable. So there are going to be benefits from the public sector doing some activity that generates knowledge that then all private sector firms can benefit from and be more productive as a result. So that's one argument for knowledge, for the public sector to have a role. Another argument is coordination externalities. So sometimes you're going to be in a situation where there's a chicken and egg dynamic. It would be productive for there to be a vibrant regional cluster around a certain type of activity, like manufacturing a certain thing or focusing on a certain scientific innovation. But no individual firm is going to be able to go and set up there because the firm needs skilled workers and it needs suppliers and it needs a whole infrastructure around it. So some of the role for knowledge generating activity by government is to also anchor, provide these coordination externalities, anchor a regional cluster. And you see that often with universities or university research institutes. Okay, so we've got two reasons why the public sector should have a role. Then the tricky part comes in saying, well, where should this role be and how big should it be? Because unlike with education or transport, it's something that is much harder to measure. How do you measure if there is capacity in a place for more knowledge generating activity to happen in a way that would spill over in some intangible way to firms and make them more productive? So the caveat here is this is very hard to measure. This is very hard to get a really detailed quantitative grasp on, in contrast maybe to some of the other things we just talked about. So what we try and do is we say, at the bare minimum, there is a bar for where we think public sector R&D activity would be effective, which is, if the private sector is doing a bunch of R&D somewhere, that suggests that there are people capable of doing this R&D activity and that there are private sector firms that are capable of absorbing it and using it for productive activities because the private sector is doing this R&D. So we look at the regional distribution of private sector R&D spend, and we look at the regional distribution of public sector and higher education R&D spend. Higher education R&D in the UK is largely publicly funded in effect. And we find that in all three cases, private, public, higher education, R&D spend disproportionately happens in the richer regions. That makes sense because these are the regions where there's a lot of scientists and researchers and productive economic activity already. But the public sector and higher education R&D is even more skewed to the rich regions than the private sector R&D is. So the private sector is more likely to be doing some of their R&D, particularly in the Midlands, parts of the north of England, than the government or higher education is. And so what we use that fact to suggest is that there is more scope for public funded R&D activity to go also to these other regions where the private sector is doing it, because there's clearly capacity in these regions both to do the R&D activity and to absorb it.
Yeah, no, that is a great point. And obviously, as you say in the paper, you're engaging in a conversation that, you know, others, Richard Jones and Tom Forth and others have sort of expressed, at least in the UK context, about thinking about these sorts of these kinds of things. To what extent, I mean, I agree that the data is difficult on this sort of stuff. We've tried to get at this in different ways, and none of it is perfect. To what extent can we be confident, or how confident can we be that there are complementarities between public R&D activities and business or private R&D activities? And what's your sense as to that?
Again, with the caveat that we don't know in every context, there's a lot of evidence of local spillovers to private firms from publicly funded and from university R&D activities in different contexts. Mm-hmm. And as an economist, I'm particularly excited when we get plausibly causal variation in these things. And there's a lot of different places that people have looked to get this, some of them in the US with the kind of construction of new universities or changes in university research funding. And pretty consistently, you see that when there are these exogenous changes in research activity or funding in certain places from the public sector or university sector, you see spillovers to local firms in terms of those firms' productivity or hiring activities. And particularly, you see those firms that are in the industries that are most related to what was being funded benefiting the most. So you really do see in lots of different settings that there is causal evidence for spillovers. The big question then becomes, number one, how big are those spillovers? And number two, how do you make the most of them? This is where it's harder to get this kind of causal evidence, but where case studies and experience from basically technology transfer type activities that link earlier stage basic research type activities that are often done by public or higher education with the applied R&D activities typically done by firms can be really important. And so everyone talks about the Fraunhofer Institutes in Germany as being a good example of how this is done well. But that kind of piece, there's definitely evidence that it is important. And then how we structure that kind of technology transfer piece is crucial.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I was going to say, I think my sense of it, an important question or a variable or factor we should have in our minds, I think, again, how we get at it is not always that clear, is the extent to which these kind of systems are to a degree open or not, right? I mean, in a sense, because I think what's interesting on the public side is that, as you say, some of it is much more basic in orientation. It tends to be fairly open, and therefore, all things being equal, we would expect externalities or spillovers to be, you know, to be more possible or probable because of the openness and because of the basic nature. Whereas some of the business related investment tends to be happening within firms. Mm-hmm. It tends to be proprietary orientated, tends to be relatively closed, but not fully closed. And so the expected spillovers, externalities we would expect, are probably not going to be as great, or at least not as great if you're only relying on of some of that kind of business investment activities. I don't know what you think about that, but I think it's a good way of trying to think about the interplay between public and private, but also open and closed access. Because you know, just on a geography scale, we see, you know, if you're looking at some, the geographical location of some firms where some of their R&D activities, particularly proprietary, or, you know, they tend to be in the middle of nowhere, you know, so they can safeguard some of that sort of stuff, whereas others tend to be, you know, in and amongst it, in surrounded by other activities. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That's the open and close is a great distinction. I would add to it that even in the cases where there's closed R&D, obviously less so if it's in a very geographically isolated place, you do see a lot of evidence for knowledge spillovers coming through basically employees moving. So yeah. One of the big, you know, one of the big sets of knowledge spillovers that helps keep Silicon Valley as productive as it is that you see so much movement of people that are working on new technologies across firms. So to the extent that firms are protecting their technologies and their innovations, but they have people that are benefiting from the learning that comes from working on them, you can still get some of those spillovers, but less so than in the open case.
Yeah, no, that is a great point. And obviously one of the reasons you see in Silicon Valley so much movement between firms and outside of firms is because there's a ready supply of risk finance, equity finance, you know, business finance more generally, which goes on to your fourth bucket seamlessly, which is access to finance broadly defined. So again, just give us a sense of what the what you're looking at and what you're finding in the sort of access to finance bucket.
Big question here is, why do we see so little of the UK's total business financing going to regions outside of London? So most financial activity happens from firms headquartered in London, and a very large share of both bank lending and equity finance goes to firms that are based in London or the Greater London agglomeration, kind of Greater South East and East region. So then the question is, are we seeing less finance flowing to firms outside of London and the South East because these firms are not able to engage in the kinds of activities that need them to have more financing? They're not able to grow, for all the other reasons we've talked about, education, transport, R&D, or is it that actually there's a lot of possible productive economic activity that could be happening if only the mostly London-based financing system of the UK would finance it? So that's a really crucial question, because if the latter is the case, then it's actually a relatively simple fix. You know, providing more financing enables a bunch of firms that have all this activity ready to go to do it. And that could be the kickstart that we need. So we look at two different aspects of financing, bank lending and then equity financing. It's worth emphasizing that bank lending is by far the lion's share of financing that goes to firms. So the question here we look at is there evidence that particularly SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, are constrained by their lack of access to bank lending? So what we want to do here is ask, is there evidence that SMEs outside of London are trying to get bank lending and can't, or they're getting bank lending, but banks are charging them higher interest rates or requiring more collateral from them than they would from firms in London? All of those would suggest that these firms are sort of more constrained in their ability to grow through accessing bank lending. We look at a lot of different metrics, both ones that we collect and ones that we analyze from other researchers, basically find on no metric any systematic evidence that SMEs outside London are more constrained in their access to bank lending than ones in London. I mean, in fact, there's this big survey that happens, the SME Finance Monitor, that surveys thousands of SMEs and asks them various questions about their access to finance. And there is no question we could find in that survey that suggests that the London-based SMEs are less constrained. In fact, on most questions, it's the opposite. On most questions, the London-based firms are the ones reporting, we want more bank lending, we can't get enough bank lending, we want more external financing. So that's our conclusion on bank lending. And I mean, I can dig more into the metrics on that if of interest. On equity financing, it's a little bit more mixed. So only about 4% of SMEs report ever using or ever wanting to use equity financing. So it's a very small share, but these are the ones on average that are going to be the ones that are going to be high growth potential, and some of them are going to grow and going to be productive and going to be the big firms of the future. So equity financing matters only for a very small share in some sense, but it's actually very crucial in another sense for generating the kind of high productivity economic activity we're talking about. When you look at equity financing, a very large share, about 90% of the disparities in equity financing across regions can be explained by different firm mix. And this is a result from Wilson, Kayser and Wright's research on this. But that remaining gap can't be explained by different firm composition, different industry composition. And it looks in particular like SMEs in the Midlands and Yorkshire, and to some extent the Northwest, are less likely to get equity financing than firms that otherwise look the same in London. And when they do get equity financing, they get less. So there's a question that this raises of whether there is still a gap in equity financing specifically for these high growth potential SMEs that could really kickstart some of this new high productivity economic activity.
Brilliant, fantastic. So we've got our sort of four culprits, I suppose, or four buckets of, you know, what the reasons and some of the factors that we think matter, but also then, you know, how they're, what the performance is, the extent to which they're binding constraints. We're not going to go into the detail of it, but it's worth saying you also look at whether internal migration can be a sort of self-correcting mechanism, where essentially we would expect, all things being equal, people to be moving from, and firms to be moving from, less productive to more productive regions. That doesn't happen in the UK. It's not because people aren't moving around. They tend to move around comparably to other places. We haven't seen the drop-off that we've seen in the US, but we do think that high housing costs particularly make it prohibitive to move from a lower cost place to London, particularly because essentially any gains through the labour market get more than washed out by high housing costs. Is that a fair sort of summary of the migration issue?
Yeah, complete summary. And one thing I would add is that we see this as a regional equity issue as well, in the sense that if you are someone that happens to be born and grow up in a non-London and the Southeast region, neither avenue to having a really high-paying, high-productivity job is open to you, because the productivity in the region that you're from is lower than we argue it could or should be. And you don't have the opportunity to move to London and take advantage of the high productivity there, because the housing costs will eat all of that up. So there's a kind of regional equity angle. It doesn't help regional growth in the non-London regions to improve housing supply in London. But A, it may help London's growth, and B, it helps at least provide avenues for people from outside of London to take advantage of that productivity growth if their own region is not doing as well as it should.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. They're a great point. There are many reasons for trying to tackle high housing costs in London and the greater Southeast more generally, which is for another podcast. Okay, so we've got our four kind of big buckets. How do we then think about, or how do you then think about the sort of relative weight that you give to them in terms of the constraint that they're placing on growth outside of the greater Southeast, Anna? You know, is it as simple as saying we can rank these 1 to 4, or, I mean, is that too a simplistic way to think about it? How do you then move from bucket analysis? These are the binding constraints, some bigger than small. Where does that, as we edge towards policy consequences or implications, how should we think about the constraints?
This is one of the areas where you can't derive entirely the prioritization from our analysis. And as with a lot of kind of policy conclusions, you have to mix what you've got from your empirical evidence with some kind of theoretical framework or read of the rest of the empirical literature. So we say of these four buckets, as I've outlined, looks like a generalized lack of graduate skills isn't that important, but a lack of STEM skills is. Transport infrastructure really matters in certain cities. R&D activity could be higher in certain places that have the potential for it. And bank lending doesn't seem to be the big issue, but there might be some issue with equity financing in some places. So we've got those sort of three and a half sets of things, if you add equity finance, that seem to matter the most. In terms of then prioritizing, you have to look at theory and other literature. So one thing I would say from the theory, and also just from looking at other countries, is it looks like the way that modern economic growth is generated is disproportionately urban, which will be something that you at the Center for Cities, I'm sure, share as a view. It's disproportionately in urban agglomerations. And that the largest urban agglomerations seem the best poised to take advantage of the forces that generate productivity in the modern economy. So what that would suggest to us is then, if we're prioritizing certain large non-London urban agglomerations that have the potential to become these high productivity international centers in some way, and focusing the resources on those would be one important point. Then I would say the other point in terms of prioritization between the buckets that comes from theory is when we look at the evidence on the economics of agglomeration, the evidence on how much size matters per se, the effective reach of a city from other countries is that it matters, but it can't explain the whole gap in the UK. So you're seeing magnitudes of something like 4 percentage points increase in productivity for every doubling of city size. So in the UK, we don't see it. As we talked about, the large cities in the UK don't have any evidence of agglomeration except London. So we can probably reap those benefits by helping make them bigger, but that won't go all the way. So that suggests transport matters, but it's not the only thing that matters. And so those are two of the pieces I would talk about to suggest prioritization. But the other theoretical framework I would say, and we kind of take this approach in the end part of the paper, is in a world of policy uncertainty, kind of makes sense to hedge your bets. So we don't know exactly whether we are in the world where knowledge spillovers are the most important thing, or whether agglomeration economies are the most important thing, or whether actually having a high STEM educated workforce share is the most important thing. So if we don't know which of these is more or less important, and there are different theories that would tell us different things, it makes sense to spread our resources by doing something in each of those buckets, but prioritizing it at the areas where we think it has the most scope to benefit.
Yeah, no, that is a great point. And, you know, I think, I agree. I mean, in the sense of the analysis, I think, you know, the way you both have to think about the policy mix and the relative weighting of policy mix in any given place. But you do have to think about spatial prioritization, because all places are not equal, and that exists within the urban frame as well as obviously urban to rural. And I think, you know, that's one of the points that we, you know, I think we've been fairly consistent on. And I think, you know, there's a, as you say, a good bunch of theoretical and empirical evidence on this, you know, that part of the problem, not all of the problem, but a big problem in the UK is the underperformance of our big urban areas outside of London. And if we can fix those to the degree that we can, that's not going to solve all the problems, but it does get us a good ways down the track. And then you have to think about the policy, the mix. And I was going to say, you know, in many respects, you know, the paper is rightly kind of emphasizing the complementarity between different types of interventions. So skills interventions need to be supported by and support transport related investments and R&D investments and so on. So, you know, all of these things are in, you know, they're in motion all at once, and you want a kind of concerted, coordinated policy, big push, I suppose, in some respects. Is that right? Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. That in some sense, all of these will interlock together. And particularly if you're thinking about something like STEM education and then R&D, building an R&D cluster of excellence around certain high knowledge intensive activities, they're going to go together very well.
Yeah. You know, and that then, you know, raises questions about, which the paper doesn't address, because you're not addressing it, but, you know, it raises questions about how we should think about timescales on these sorts of things, continuity, you know, with flexibility, but continuity is really quite important. And then you simply can't get away from the fact that doing this sort of stuff is going to require substantive amounts of investment. Some of it's going to come from the private sector through the things that we've talked about, but some of it definitely is going to come from the public sector in various guises as well. Is that your sense as well?
Yes. And we don't tackle it in this paper, as you said, but we have another project from our research team, which is Dan and Ed and two other scholars, Niesha Weinberg and Esme Elston, who are working on a comparative history project where they have interviewed over 80 leading UK policymakers and practitioners in regional policy from 1979 to 2015, including, I think, all or almost all of the living former chancellors of the Exchequer, number of former prime ministers, number of former regional and local policymakers. And that is trying to get really at these slightly more intangible factors that are hard to quantify on governance, on policy continuity, on scale. And that paper's not out yet, so I won't sort of preface all the conclusions, but I think one of the big points is exactly as you emphasize, Andrew, that what we need here is large scale, systematic and long-term continuity, continuous investment in places where there is enough time and there is enough scope for the regional economy to settle into a new equilibrium. And what we've seen over the last 40 plus years has really been a lot of chopping and changing of different policy regimes, of different kinds of funding activity, none of which has been at the scale or at the time span to really give a chance for major regional revitalization of the kind that would be needed.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you say when you're doing the analysis of the, you know, of the four areas, you know, it's fair to say, you know, the UK did have a big push on graduate expansion, for example, right? We went from relatively low numbers to quite big numbers, and that was a very deliberate British state approach, which had very specific spatial implications because of the nature of, you know, where the institutions were and where those people were coming from, etc. So you can see a kind of big push in one of the buckets. I think it's fair to say that in the other three buckets, it's been slightly more marginal, very much more stop start, or some, you know, more cynical would say we haven't really tried, you know, in the sense which I have some sympathy with. And, you know, again, it's useful to just to think about, you know, the scale and size of the things. You know, we like to, just as way of contextualizing the scale of it, is to compare, you know, the kind of expenditures around leveling up that the current government is talking about, and the sort of expenditures that, say, the German state has gone through over the last 30 odd years through unification. You know, they're very different. You know, one is very large and one is not so large. And I'll leave you to decide, you know, you will know and listeners will know which one is very large and which one is not. But, you know, there is a scale and a concerted effort, I think, which is really, really required. I'm interested in how we create a policy environment that allows these things to kind of happen.
I think that's right. And I think the example of higher education is a really good one, because it's something where there was, as you say, this big push. It really radically transformed the, everything about the UK economic landscape and landscape of economic opportunity as well. And it was very successful in many ways. We can quibble about certain things, but it was very successful both on the regional and the national level, I think, at boosting productivity and alleviating these constraints. So there is a way for the UK state to do a big push when it wants to. And the other thing I would note is that on the other areas, it's not just that there hasn't been a big push, but actually that the UK has looked, if anything, below average in international context. So on transport spending, for example, since the mid-90s, where the OECD produced comparable data across lots of different countries, the UK's spending on roads as a share of GDP has been well below the OECD average. And spending on rail until recent years has also been mostly below. Recent years, it's actually shot up with all the big rail projects that we've seen happening. And then, of course, within the UK, because most of the rail spending has been London and the South focused, that spending is also very geographically disparate. So if you think about how much of GDP has been spent on transport infrastructure outside London and the South and maybe Midlands of England, if you're talking about high speed two, then it's been very small. So there is scope to do more, not just in a big push sense, but just to get us to where other countries already have been. On R&D, it looks relatively similar. So the ONS just revised their R&D statistics, the way they measure R&D recently, to make it more comparable to other countries. So until that revision, it looked like the UK was a real outlier in terms of being below OECD average in terms of how much we spend on R&D. Now it looks like we're closer to average. But being average, you know, shouldn't be a great consolation. You know, maybe we actually want to be prioritizing even more the spending on the knowledge generating activity that's going to boost growth longer term. So there's scope for it. The other thing I would say, the German example is both an inspiration and I think a cause for pause, right? Because there were these huge gaps in when Germany was reunified. Germany is one of the only countries that has seen really strong convergence between its poor and its rich regions. The scale of the effort required to achieve that in terms of finance and in terms of policy will and political will was really huge.
Yeah.
So it gives us the sense of possibility that there can be major regional convergence, but also I think a real sense of the scale and commitment that's required to do it.
Yeah, and it's to the degree to which that is replicable and, you know, under what conditions, I think is a very, very good point. Some of my colleagues are just doing a bit more work looking at the Italian example, which, you know, we know a lot about the national sort of situation and the relative decline of Italian productivity and, you know, economic performance over time. But also there's, again, a sort of fairly longish history of relatively unsuccessful, you know, attempts to try and deal with the north-south differentials that have been there for quite some time and haven't shown any movement towards convergence, over time, which is, which, as you say, there's places to look for hope, but we have to be conditional on those. And then sadly, there are other places as well. But I think the point, I don't know what I think one of the points that we try to make when we're talking about this sort of stuff is that we should think about, it's not comparing, regions to regions is one thing, but we really, I think we can be fairly comfortable that there's no inherent reason why Greater Manchester's productivity performance should be demonstrably below what we would expect it to when we look at comparable cities elsewhere, right? I mean, that's, there we can compare biggish cities to biggish cities, and it's very hard to explain the productivity differentials and say, well, it's just the way it is, which is a slightly different thing. And I think, getting into that kind of conversation may be a way to try and deal with some of the, the what's the point type of things.
Yeah, and I think the research that you and your colleagues have done demonstrating exactly that, the underperformance internationally of the UK's large non-London cities, has been one of the most striking facts there, because it really does say, maybe it's not possible to turn a small city into a massive global city like London and New York, but it certainly should be possible to turn a 2 million people city in the UK into whatever a 2 million people city can do in France. Like, that is definitely achievable.
Yeah, that is a very good point. To bring us to a close, Anna, I mean, you talked about the paper that colleagues that you worked on the first paper are doing around governance and institutions and the sort of that kind of framework. You also talked or alluded to earlier on about some further work that you're doing. Just give us a sense as to, this is the paper as is, has it prompted, has it prompted additional work that you're doing? And if so, can you, tell us what that is?
Yeah, so we're doing this as a kind of three-portion research project with this team of five that I mentioned. So this is doing the kind of quantitative economic international comparative analysis. We have the team doing the work on comparative history and interviews and drawing out lessons on governance and policy practice. And then we're going to, in the third piece, try and tie this all together and draw out basically lessons for policy. In terms of the next steps on this specific part of the analysis, the quantitative piece, I think, as you said, one of the big areas that people have been interested in is education. And what we're going to be trying to do is getting more granular, looking at cities, not just regions, and looking at qualifications from specific places. So is it also the case that a Russell Group graduate in London versus in Manchester is getting very different patterns of returns over time? And what can we infer from that? We're also going to be digging a little bit more into a kind of another intangible thing that seems really important, which is the strength and depth of entrepreneurial ecosystems. So can we look at finance and knowledge and mentorship separately, or do we need to look at them all together to try to understand what's going to really generate these high productivity firms?
Oh, fantastic. Plenty more reasons to have you back on to discuss those and other matters. Anna, you've been a brilliant guest. Thank you very much for being part of City Talks. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. It's been a really great conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.